Welcome to the Total Soccer Show's weekend review. And yes, in a season where Bayern were caught snoozing, Neverkusen have transformed into never losing. The drink that was sprayed was beer, not champagne, as Die Werkself were toasting to the curse of Harry Kane. In the Premier League, wins at the very top were vital, but it was a weekend where Man City were basically handed the title. On Sunday, we saw Liverpool recreate the Anfield slip, and then Arsenal took an unexpected dip. Hopefully, the title race isn't all over, but it was a pretty good weekend for Pep Guardiola. Elsewhere, Newcastle put a tired Tottenham to bed. Lionel Messi done a goal at Arrowhead. And of course, we celebrate the League Two promotion dream for Wrexham AFC, America's team. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, your friend and mine, Taylor Rockwell. Hello, Taylor Rockwell.
Hello, Ryan Bailey. How are you, my friend?
I've been better. My voice, yes. If I have to cough during this episode, I do apologise, Tay-Tay. Kids give you illnesses occasionally is a thing we know full and well on TSS.
Yes, I'm excited for the day. One day, many years from now, when all four of us are healthy at the same time. Joe has not had any of these issues, but especially springtime, I'm guessing, in Virginia, but also in North Carolina. Pollen everywhere, red eyes everywhere. It's been fun. It's been a lot of fun. I have one kid home today as well. But Ryan, I hope you feel better as this episode progresses. Maybe talking about a team being promoted out of League Two will do that for you. No?
Yes.
Won't? Okay.
Well, my team not going to be promoted out of League Two, sadly, yeah. Taylor, but we shall talk about that later indeed. Joe Lowry, how are you? Pollen count? Pleasingly low in Arizona.
I don't know. I don't know how to yes and pollen count, guys. I wasn't prepared.
They got flowers
for this
in Arizona. Just sand.
Yeah, just sand. Just tarantulas, which apparently are a real thing. I think that was Climbing Cantor in the Discord who told me that we do in fact have tarantulas in Arizona. I'm just not going to the tarantula parts, which I don't feel like is something I should be criticized for.
You think you're not? You just didn't see them.
How does one avoid those?
I don't like this. Ryan, please introduce Graham.
Very well, Graham Ruthven. Any spider-related mishaps in Glasgow lately?
Well, Queen's Park are nicknamed the Spiders, and they play at Hampden Park, but other than that, not many spiders. Certainly not big spiders in Glasgow. Hello, Ryan. How are you? Did you have a good weekend watching? This is my main question today. Did you have a good weekend watching dog racing on ESPN? Checks notes. Tell me how that went.
Yeah. So flicking through my television on the Fubo last night, Graham, ESPN2, dog racing. They had a track, various makes and models of dogs. They put anything on ESPN, is what I've learned since living here. You have spelling bees, you have hot dog eating, you get, what's the one where you throw the sack into the board?
Cornhole.
Yeah, these are all sports, Graham. Didn't you know?
I forgot that Joe loves cornhole. Yeah. Remember that from earlier.
You throw
from
the
past
sack into the hole? Wake up, dude. You live in the South. It's 2024.
The real question
that everybody wants to know is how much money did you bet on the Greyhound on the inside track? That's what I would like to know.
Are you asking if I had the inside track on the inside track, Greyhound, Joe?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
A gentleman never tells.
Has anyone here ever actually wagered on dog racing? I've wagered on horse racing.
I didn't know it was a thing until last night, Taylor, frankly.
Well, you really get like greyhound racing, right?
Yeah,
like
this
in
wasn't,
the UK.
This
is,
wasn't
is,
on
a thing.
So that's a formalized thing on a track where you've got greyhounds and they wear numbers and
was
stuff.
This like was this like an underground operation with one camera?
This one it was just a bunch of dogs like of all different breeds just
like a
having
poodle,
a lovely time.
A poodle versus a chihuahua.
But all okay, taken very seriously.
I would watch that. Small dog racing would be hilarious and awesome.
Gerard Piqué is his interest has peaked.
Ryan, Simpson superfan number one, I'm very surprised to hear you say that you didn't know dog racing was a thing when Santa's Little Helper, I believe, is a greyhound.
Yeah, that's the whole
that
thing.
Is retired. That's where they get him from, right? They get him from the dog track?
AFC Wimbledon Stadium is built on a greyhound track. AFC Richmond are called the Greyhounds.
So what part of this are you confused about, Ryan? That's what I think what we're all wondering.
It wasn't greyhound racing, Joe. It was they were in a field and they were in... I wish I could describe it better than I am.
We can
frankly
all just agree that Ryan is making this up, right? And collectively
does
move on.
Does kind of feel that way.
Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show. If you'd like to access our bonus content, more dog chat on there, I am sure. Going on the feed this week, we have Weekend Review Extra. So much weekend, so little time. We're going to put a little bit extra in there. Going to talk more about Wrexham's title win, Scottish and Portuguese title races as well, and much, 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 much more. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show if you would like to support this enterprise, please and thank you. But for now, why don't we go to the Bundesliga, where on Sunday, Leverkusen won the Bundesliga for the first time in their 120-year history. First non-Bayern team to do it since 2012. Leverkusen with a 5-0 win over Werder Bremen to get that Meisterschale nicely out of Bavaria for one season at least. Taylor, we have Leverkusen, your favourite team of all time, celebrating a title undefeated with 5 games to spare. Supporters on the field in something that was very chaotic looking for German soccer, I should say. And the team on course for a treble as well. All is good with your favourite team of all time.
Indeed. So good, in fact, that what I will do is instead redirect us back to the American Kennel Club's Fastest Dogs USA competition, highlights a select group of the quickest canines competing in a sport that will allow multiple breeds to race each other. Okay. Okay, Ryan Bailey. You were telling the truth. It's verified. As to Leverkusen, it is pretty amazing what they have done. We talked about this last
Never
week.
Never let anything
this
go.
Was the... No. I've wanted to know. I was curious. Now I want to see a Pomeranian race and see how badly it would do. To the Leverkusen point, though, we talked about this last week as to whether or not this is the most impressive non-Champions League campaign season, and that they continue to do what they are doing in such emphatic fashion, in this case, winning handily, never feeling like the pressure was there, even though it's at home. The streets are being named after Xabi Alonso. Everybody is there expecting. And we have seen teams trip up here, not necessarily give away the title race or anything like that, but maybe at the first time of asking, they don't end up getting across the hurdle. Here, Leverkusen more than did. They continued to be never losing, as Ryan said in the introduction. I enjoyed the ESPN Deportes commentators saying that multiple times throughout this game, especially as they added more and more goals. But it was a pretty comprehensively solid performance across the board, which is representative of a pretty comprehensively solid season so far for Leverkusen.
Joe, how far can this team go? Trebs? Trebs? Yeah? Yeah?
Can they? Yes, I think. Trebs? Let's do Trebs. I mean, this team genuinely continues to impress me more and more each time that I watch them. I put down in our doc that this is a team that I'm going to remember for a long time. And we've talked about before amongst the four of us how difficult it is at times to keep track of everything that's going on in the soccer world. And so for me, that's one of the biggest compliments I can pay this Bayer Leverkusen team is that I will remember them for so long. Ryan, you mentioned how, you know, it's been Bayern Munich who wins this thing every single year. And we know that. We expect it. And it is, to be honest, a legitimate problem that the Bundesliga has on their hands. Just one that they can afford to ignore for a season, because this Leverkusen team has been built incredibly well by the front office. The talent that they've assembled is absurdly impressive and is a team that I think is set up, if these pieces stay, to pose another real threat to Bayern Munich next season. But it is also credit to Xabi Alonso, credit to the individual players who have come out and gotten results. Florian Wirtz bags, you know, goal after goal after goal. He snags a hat trick in this game. Like, they just absolutely jack stomped Werder Bremen in this match. And they've done that to so many teams in so many competitions this season. I have so much respect for what this group has accomplished. They are so much fun to watch. And as a neutral, that's like a huge part that I admire them for as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a triumph that, speaking for myself, it kind of reaffirms my faith in football a little bit, because this is an age where money seems to dictate everything, and this is a weekend which, spoiler alert, we'll talk about how Manchester City have taken control of the title race in England, and they're going for 4 titles in a row. And as good as last week's Champions League games were, you know, the teams involved are Real Madrid and Barca and Bayern and PSG and Manchester City and Arsenal. It's all the members of the elite, right? It's the Super League clubs. But then you get something like Leverkusen, where they are just exceptionally good despite having a squad that was assembled for less than Bayern paid for. I think Harry Kane and Dayo Upamecano was the stat that I saw. Even something like, going back to last week, Athletic Club winning the Copa del Rey and seeing what that meant to them and the celebrations on the Gabara on the river on Thursday. It's a reminder of what this game can produce, and I love it for that. So I'm very much, I've had a great time watching Leverkusen this season. I'm delighted that they got over the line.
Joe, I'm interested to hear more about you remembering this team, because I think I will remember them for sort of breaking that Bayern Munich dominance for sure. I think I will most likely probably remember them for Xabi Alonso managing them, especially if he does more with this team or if he has more successes in his career. To me, it will be, this is the thing that launched him into kind of superstardom of the managerial realm. For you, is it a Xabi Alonso thing, or are there individual players, or is it more so the collective performance that you will remember?
Well, it's kind of the cop-out, and I guess more the last one than the first two, but it's all of them, right? It's absolutely all of them to go out and perform at this level for this long in a league that has been historically dominated by one club in Bayern Munich at least in recent history, I suppose. Like, you need all of those things to go your way. You need to have a collective style that allows you to get more than the sum of your parts out of the sum of your parts. You need to have top level players who can go out there and perform and score the kinds of goals that Bayer Leverkusen scored against Werder Bremen. That Granit Xhaka strike is absolutely unbelievable. Yeah. Is it repeatable? Not really. Is it awesome? Absolutely it is. You need those kinds of moments, and you need to do it with a ton of talent, both in your starting 11 and on the bench. And this Leverkusen team dealt with some injuries this year, as every team does. They dealt with absences for AFCON. Like, they sort of conquered all of those things. They jumped over every hurdle, and they did it while playing. And this is something that I think I really will remember. And Taylor, you got to a bit of this. They did it while playing a style that is just really, really fun to watch. Like, yeah. I would rather remember this Leverkusen team than some of the Atleti teams that did very, very well in La Liga not too long ago now, although it's been several years. Like, this is a team between the style of play, between Xabi Alonso, who does very much feel like a rising force in the managerial realm, and some of the talent that they have that, make no mistake, whether it's next year or the year after, will be playing for other high-level clubs that probably fit the bill that Graham described for the current Champions League group. Eventually, this will disband, but I think the legacy of this team, even though we all recognize they're not likely to compete year after year after year at the top, because, let's face it, despite Graham's renewed faith in football, that is still how this sport works, we will remember them long after they have all disbanded across Europe.
Yeah, they're just utterly relentless as a team, aren't they? And this match, of course, kind of became a bit of an afterthought to the celebrations. I loved all the fans. After the fourth goal, they kind of do a mini pitch invasion, then the security pushes them back to the perimeter of the pitch. So by the time you get to the end of this game, the crowd is on the throw-in line all the way around the pitch waiting to storm on, and then the referee just decides to end it on 90 minutes, no stoppage time, and the pitch invasion happens. So the match itself kind of became a bit of an afterthought, but it was an illustration of just how good they are. They are relentless as a team. Some of the execution with their crosses and their passes from one side to the runner on the other side, the finishes from Xhaka and Verts that Joe highlights, they are a punch in the face of a soccer team in everything that they do. They have such force. At least once they get into the attack, they have such force, there's such intensity. They score so many late goals, and they did it in this game as well. It's 1-0 until pretty late in this game. They score so many late goals because they ask so many questions of you as an opponent. Teams can't live with them for 90 minutes. And obviously, Xabi Alonso deserves a huge amount of praise for that. I do think in history, this is probably going to be looked back upon as the Xabi Alonso triumph. But also, a lot of praise should go to Simon Rolfes, who is the sporting director at Bayer Leverkusen. Some of the business that they've done recently, particularly last summer, has been tremendous. Last summer, the players that Leverkusen brought in were Alex Grimaldo, Granit Xhaka, Jonas Hofmann, Nathan Teller, and Victor Boniface. That's a 100% hit rate on those players. And while that might not be sustainable going forward, it says to me that there's a clear idea of what this team should be and the type of players that should play for them. And Rolfes has led that. And Xabi Alonso is a manifestation of that. And I'm not saying that after Alonso leaves, inevitably, as will happen at some point in the future, that Leverkusen are going to do this again. But I would be encouraged, if I was a fan of that club, that there at least seems to be the structure, there seems to be a coherent vision of what that club should be. And I expect they will continue to compete, at least in Germany, for years to come.
It does feel like there's a blueprint there, to your point, Graham, and that even if Xabi Alonso does move on, you can bring in someone with similar ideals or a similar approach, and maybe they're not going to win the Bundesliga with an undefeated record, but they may continue to perform really well and keep that level of performance up. I went back and watched the very first game of the season, the first game that in my notes had me just getting increasingly hyped about Bayer Leverkusen. Or I didn't go back and watch, I went back and read my notes, excuse me. And the thing that stood out to me is it's that quote from Johan Cruyff. Playing football is very simple, but playing simple football is the hardest thing there is. And that's what Bayer Leverkusen have done from the start of this season. They do somewhat simple things, or they do very complex things, but make them look simple. When this player advances into this position, this player moves over to cover so that they're not vulnerable to this. This guy can then step into this area, and there's just solutions every step of the way. But they're so well drilled that everybody knows what they need to do, where they need to be. And then as the season has progressed, they have the depth that has figured that out as well and can come in and deputize and knows their responsibilities. I think they do still have key performers that if they had lost for huge chunks of the season, maybe it goes differently. But how well drilled they are, how simplistic they can look at times, in a non like pejorative way, they just look so impressive because everyone knows their assignments, so that they move as a unit. You can see what they're doing, but it's also really difficult to attack. It's really difficult to defend, because even if you know how they're going to play, for them to execute that efficiently, that consistently, it's just hard to find a way through that, as we've seen this season.
There were great scenes at the Bay Arena. As you say, Graham, credit to the referee for blowing up early in this one. He saw a couple of pitch invasions for those late goals and then decided, yeah, let's just wrap this thing up. I think that's perhaps the best performance of the day there. We have Chemi Alonso in the Champions League next season. Very exciting indeed. I also think credit to Bayern for winning on Saturday that 2-0 win over Cologne, which allowed Bayer Leverkusen to celebrate in their home stadium rather than a all-round Jamie Vardy's house to celebrate the title situation that we've seen previously.
I was pleased for them that they had this moment, because it seemed like a cathartic experience for a club that has never had this sort of thing before. So had it been a title clinch by a Bayern losing a game and they weren't involved, it would have felt a little bit anticlimactic, but these scenes will live on forever. And I just thought there was so much to love about what happened after full time. I think I've said this on the show before, but I love Jeremy Frimpong. He's a great character, and he gave a great interview to Archie Rintoot on ESPN, where he might have had a few drinks at this point, and he said that Xabi Alonso was looking for him to drench him in beer, as they do in Germany when they celebrate titles. And Archie Rintoot was like, "So you're basically hiding, giving this interview?" "Yes, exactly. Yeah. I'm hiding from my manager." And I loved when all the fans are invading the pitch, Frimpong, the security's trying to get him out of the crowd, and he's like trying to stay in among the supporters. I just think he's a fantastic character. And then there was King Xavi, as he's been crowned by the Leverkusen fans, addressing all the fans on the pitch. Joe says you'll remember this team for a long time, and I will too, but I kind of think I'll remember these celebrations even longer, because it was just something, obviously, Leverkusen have never had before.
Yeah, Frimpong, that interview, you should definitely look it up, listener. Leaning on Archie Rintoul for the entirety of it. He's having a lovely old time.
And he tells him, "I like the pink shirt, you look very handsome in it." He's just fantastic, Jeremy Frimpong.
Good stuff all around. Fun Bundesliga stat for the first time in his career. Kingsley Coman will finish a season without being crowned champion of the league he's playing in. His first title was in 2012-13 with PSG. The Kane streak of not winning titles stronger than the Coman streak of winning them, evidently. So there we go. All right, congratulations to Bayer Leverkusen. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking Premier League. Back shortly.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to the weekend review. We go to the Premier League, where there was plenty of action at the top of the table between the top teams, City, Liverpool and Arsenal. Man City, the only one registering some points this weekend, Graham. A 5-1 win over Luton put them top on Saturday. Haaland with a super on-target volley to put the game beyond doubt. Nice goals from Guardiola and Doku as well in this one. First league game they've won without Rodri, says here, Graham. That's quite impressive, is it not?
Well, I think Rodri was at home. Did he even watch this game? He was watching something.
He was resting.
Netflix.
He's not watching anything. Yeah.
He was watching Netflix. Netflix and chill. An unsurprising outcome, obviously, given the contrasting strength between these two teams. What I will say is Luton defended doggedly for a lot of this match, and you could see what their game plan was on the defensive side. At least they wanted to force City wide and then clog up the penalty box, and the numbers they were getting back into that area. There were times when there were like 8 or 9 Luton players inside their own box, and naturally that makes it difficult for Manchester City to play through. On the attacking side, though, Luton offered next to nothing because of the distance they had to bridge into Carlton Morris. Their goal came from some slack possession play from City playing out from the back. But in the end, even against a low defensive block, City just had too much. The possession they had, the waves of the attack. I thought Jeremy Doku, you mentioned him, Ryan, was one of the players who really opened up the game for City in the second half. He had more touches of the ball in the Luton box after halftime, and he was clearer in his determination to kind of drive at the opposition when he was able to isolate them one-on-one. He won the penalty to make it 3-0, which effectively killed the game as a contest, and then his goal to make it 4-1 is ridiculous. When you watch it back, it's not entirely clear how he actually gets the ball through so many sets of legs. But that's the sort of thing that Jeremy Doku does. And in the end, a very comfortable win for Man City.
All right, quick quiz question for everyone. How old is Jeremy Doku? How old is Jeremy Doku? Ryan looks like
he wants to guess first.
Ryan, you want to guess first?
23?
Taylor, you look like you want to guess second.
He's either 20 or 21.
Graham?
21, but the way that you're framing this makes me think he's much older than
Graham's right. I thought he was older. Ryan and I are more on the same page. 21 years old, and the way that he impacted this game, I think he's extremely impressive. I have one more beat on him. But first, Ryan, you mentioned the Rodri thing. He comes out after the Real Madrid game and says, yeah, I need a rest. And it seemed like Pep had some pre-planned rotation for this game, and that's very, very much what we saw. For this City team, and I know it's routine, but it's so hard to let the fact that it's routine not detract from how impressive it is, but it is impressive, and I want to talk about it. For this City team to win this game so handily, and I know it sort of took them a bit of a burst in the second half, but still, they did win this game handily, 37 shots to 4. That tells a lot of the story. For them to win this match by such a wide margin after that taxing 3-3 draw with Real Madrid, and after rotating 6 starters from that game on Tuesday, is just wildly impressive to me. 5 outfield starters, if you want to look at it that way. Like, this was more than half the lineup changed for a key Premier League game. Like, every game at this point in the Premier League is key because we still do have a bit of a title race, although it seems like maybe a Greyhound versus Taylor, what was that dog breed you mentioned earlier that would be bad at dog racing?
Pomeranian.
Yeah, it feels a bit maybe like a Greyhound versus a Pomeranian at this point, but they're still on the track and you can still sort of see the last two dogs in the camera lens. What City did while still keeping themselves in a really, really good spot in the Champions League coming up in a couple of days or later this week, whenever you're listening to this episode, is extremely impressive to me. Now, looking at Jeremy Doku, because he was the story for me in this game as an individual, he does so many things well, crashing the box off the ball, just so hard to deal with his mixture of speed and 1v1 ability that he does all this at 21 is scary for every team coming up against City or Belgium anytime soon. He earns the penalty kick for the third goal. He scores the fourth goal for City, driving inside on that right foot. And then maybe the moment I like the most in this game from Doku is in the fifth goal. He gets the assist, and he's driving down the left side, playing on the left wing for City in this game. He's driving down the left side, and 3 Luton players are dragged towards him. Like, they realize, holy crap, this guy just scored on us like 4 minutes ago. We have to take care of business. Doku draws those 3 players to him, and as Guardiola crashes towards the top of the box, just plays a simple little cutback over to Guardiola, who finishes. It's a great finish from Guardiola, who does deserve the majority of the credit. But that's how dangerous Jeremy Doku is. when he goes and has one of those slaloming runs, defenses realize they have to respect him even more than they already did from the film they watched coming into the game. That creates space elsewhere. This is what the best teams in the world do. And City right now really do look like the best team in the world. They put their opponents in impossible situations. Jeremy Doku did that for a big chunk of this game. Man City did that for a big chunk of this game. And they are almost certainly going to win the title at this point.
Yeah. Wow. I think one final note for me on this one is just it's the thing we've talked about many times with Man City, how good they are, but also just the depth that they have. And Joe talked about this with that squad rotation. You look at Arsenal playing a strong Aston Villa team, a team that beat them earlier in the season, and you wouldn't expect them to rotate, but I'm also not sure they really have the depth there to be able to rotate and still have that same quality. Liverpool obviously dealing with a number of issues and a more threadbare squad of sorts. I don't think either one was able to rotate the way Man City were able to. All three still have important European games to play this week. So it was interesting to me that that is just another sign of how strong this Man City team can be, that they can rotate five and six players and still get a resounding performance, whereas Arsenal, Liverpool, you see them struggle and not be able to rotate players and rest players. So I guess it's a credit to Man City for having everybody on the same page, as I talked about with Leverkusen, but it also does feel like a slight competitive advantage.
Yeah, and that result was one we expected from Man City on Saturday. That put them 2 points clear on 73 points after 32 games. We were expecting Liverpool and Arsenal to perhaps leapfrog them with their respective games on Sunday. That didn't happen, of course. Liverpool with a 1-0 home defeat to Crystal Palace. Ebiezie with the only goal in that one. A nice one it was too as well. Liverpool's second home loss this week. Not a great week in general for Liverpool, we could say.
I would say a bad week.
Yeah, a bad one if you go extend back to last weekend. Indeed. Graham, how didn't they win this? Like, finishing letting this team down has been a theme for a few games now, it appears. But come on, what happened here?
So this result, obviously, the two games we're going to talk about next are this one and the Arsenal-Aston Villa game, two defeats for the two title challengers, and obviously a similarly profound impact on both Liverpool and Arsenal. But I do think this match was different in that, and we'll talk a little bit later about the Arsenal-Villa game, but this match, Liverpool probably won this game on another day. The XG favoured them. It was close to three. It was like 2.8 or something like that. They had a lot of shots. They created openings. The problem is, we've said that a few times about Liverpool recently. We certainly said it against Manchester United last weekend. I just kind of, and look, I'm kind of scrambling for explanations at this point, but I just wonder if that's a consequence of weariness. I watched them against Atalanta in the Europa League during the week, and that was the performance of a tired team. So maybe there was some knock-on here. Maybe that explains the lack of sharpness, some of the lapses in concentration. I think we saw Wataru Endo have his worst game in a Liverpool shirt in central midfield with just how slack he was. Kanate as well making really uncharacteristic mistakes. So maybe all those injuries that Liverpool had earlier in the season, while they were able to get through that period, maybe it's now that it's catching up with some players. That's kind of my only theory that I have, because otherwise they are creating opportunities. And as I say, on another day, they score a couple of the opportunities that they created. But this has been a trend for this Liverpool team in the past month or so.
I don't think that's a bad theory, Graham. I also just want to toss out, and it's not a satisfying explanation, to be clear. Like, I'm not expecting Liverpool fans to come away and say, oh, that makes me feel better. You probably shouldn't feel better after this weekend, because this was a really, really bad weekend. Sometimes even great teams just miss chances. Like, that is how soccer works. And it honestly really irks me, in case people haven't realized this by now, when you have, you know, folks on TV broadcasts or whatever it is that are talking about these kinds of games and just sort of gloss over that point. Sometimes the ball does not go in the back of the net and you create great chances. It doesn't always have to be a direct cause of exhaustion, although it might be. It doesn't always have to be a direct cause of a lack of focus, although it might be. If anybody out there has watched soccer for any length of time, you'll see that in both consequential games and inconsequential ones, sometimes teams go out there and create a ton of chances and they don't finish. I was curious to check Liverpool's goal tally versus their expected goals this season. They still overperformed over the course of the season. In general, they're scoring slightly more goals this year. I think it's like at one or two goals over expected. Like, they're scoring more than you would expect them to. Now, it's unfortunate for them, and I'm not denying it, that their misses came at a really poor time. And even more than that in this game, I think the unfortunate bit for Liverpool is how much they lacked energy coming out in this first half, which, Graham, could tie into the tired point that you mentioned. They conceded a handful of very quality chances to Crystal Palace in the first 45 minutes. The goal sequence for Palace is probably the most notable one because it does end up in the back of the net. But Liverpool, it looked to me, were like sort of a step off the pace from the beginning of this game, not just in the attack, but on the defensive end.
Yeah. That's the part of their performance, Joe, that maybe leads to the theory about weariness. Some
sure.
of the not so much missing chances.
I think that's a fine theory. I was just talking about sort of when it comes to finishing chances, sometimes like the explanations are kind of hard to find.
The other thing that can happen is that even a title challenging team can come up against an opponent that gets hot, right? As I go back to that Atalanta game in the Europa League, that was a poor performance by Liverpool, no two ways about it, but Atalanta were tremendous, and I want to make sure we give Crystal Palace some praise from this match, because they did a lot of good things here. I thought we saw some of how Oliver Glasner is trying to change them with the 3-4-3 shape that gave Palace real balance in the defensive and an attacking sense, especially in the first 30 minutes when it felt like Palace were able to get in between the lines and activate their best players really effectively, particularly down the left side, which is where the goal came from. And you had that little trio of Mateta, Eze and Mitchell close together. They combined really nicely. The way that Palace executed on the counter was also really sharp. I thought Adam Wharton in central midfield was excellent. He was so clean with everything he did, whether it was his long passing, which he completed 100% of, or his tackles, or his feeding of the runners on the break. He's very press resistant. He's good in tight areas. Liverpool couldn't get near him. And you compare his performance to Endo, how sharp Wharton was and how slack Endo was, and obviously they play a similar role in a similar position. Wharton was the far better player in this match. You look at Palace's touch map and he is smack bang in the middle of the centre circle, and it really felt like watching this game, things revolved around him. He's only 20 years old and he's sort of flown under the radar a little bit since joining from Blackburn Rovers in the January window. I think he cost them like £20 million. But he is a big talent, and I expect going forward under Oliver Glasner, he will be a key part of this team.
Yeah, Taylor, when Jurgen Klopp announced his departure from Liverpool, they were on for like four trophies. It looked like they were building towards perhaps a Europa League final in Dublin, which, you know, Liverpool being a very Irish city as well. It felt like there could be a special climax to this season. And looking at it now with the Premier League title, it's not slipping away. They're 2 points behind. But, you know, advantage to City, a mountain to climb against Atalanta in Europa League. What do we think about Klopp's eventual departure? Has it gone to script? I suppose it probably hasn't in some respects. And we've seen this sort of narrative coming out that, oh, in 9 years, he's only won as many titles as Claudio Ranieri and all this kind of stuff, like, which feels like a nonsense given how many times they've come, you know, they've been silver medalists in quite a few things in Klopp's reign as well. Do we feel like this ending might affect his legacy in any way?
I hope not. I don't think it should. I've seen that narrative. I can't tell if that's just like opposition fans waiting to have their sort of shots. But yeah, this weekend I saw a bunch of like one league title in 9 years, only two major pieces of silverware in 9 years. And first of all, to win a league and to win the Champions League is pretty good for any manager. So I think we could start there. But I think it's also worth going back and remembering what Liverpool were, what they look like when he takes them over. And they are not anything approximating what they are now. They certainly did not have the standing. I mean, they still have the name. They will always have the name. They will always have that level of standing. But they were not, I would say, a premier destination for world-class players to go. Some would say maybe they still aren't because of the way FSG spends money, but I would say they are. And I think that they do feel like they are back on top in that way, even if they are second or third in the league at the end of the season. There's still an attractive place to go. There is still a mentality. There is still a fortress atmosphere to Anfield. There is still a belief in that squad. And even if they didn't get the result on the day, it still just feels like a place that will continue to pull in talent, to continue to draw big name managers. And that really had not been the case for them for a couple of seasons until Klopp comes in. So I think in that way, he will be beloved and respected and remembered for Liverpool supporters. I do think there is probably a feeling of what could have been. And maybe that's where they spring a surprise and turn things around against Atalanta. It's a big task, but I think there was a hope that maybe they could have finished this season with a little bit of silverware. I think I agree with Joe and Graham, because I think they largely are agreeing, which is just that this game felt like one that if it's the season that they win the title and kind of everybody is feeling it and they're in their flow state, I think some of these are goals. But I that's what I kept finding myself thinking, and not even in a comparative negative way, just a like, Sadio Mane flying at a defender beats that guy and scores. Sadio Mane flying in at the far post to get this volley, maybe he puts that one in. Maybe Firmino does as well. And it just feels like there was that lack of a step. Maybe there was some fatigue. Maybe there was a little bit of a lack of belief as the game goes on. But I just think this wasn't their day. And when you have somebody like Man City who could make every day their day, you can't kind of have these performances. Frustrating as they may have been with Dean Henderson making ridiculous saves, at least one of which I'm not even sure he knew he made. And it's worth noting, Palace have, what, the one saved off the line by Andy Robertson. They have another point-blank save from Alisson, or he has two in a row, I think, in this one. So Palace had more chances. It's a credit to Liverpool that it only was the one. But at the same time, with Liverpool not being able to take any of their chances themselves, it ends up being very much a what-could-have-been game, and probably one that if City end up winning the title, we look back upon as what was the problem for Liverpool the whole season, which was a lack of depth and a lack of that killer instinct when it really mattered.
Yeah, it'll be remiss of us, by the way, not to mention that today marks the 35th anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster, when 97 people were unlawfully killed in a deadly crush attending an FA Cup semi-final at Sheffield Wednesday's home ground, Hillsborough. No one should ever go to a soccer match and not come home. Our thoughts with all who continue to be affected by that tragedy. So Liverpool with a 1-0 home defeat at Palace. Later on Sunday, Arsenal messing up at home, Graham. A 2-0 home loss to Aston Villa. Perhaps the afternoon when Arsenal let it slip. Let's give credit to Aston Villa as well. Brilliant performance for them. What did we make of Arsenal doing what they did?
Unfortunate for a neutral who, speaking for myself, I just want an exciting title race. And now you look at their set your 2 points ahead. What's it, 6 games to go? And you look through their fixture list. And look, I know teams can slip up anywhere. And City this season have been more vulnerable than we have seen in past seasons. So I'm reluctant to say it's over at this stage. But you look through the fixtures. And with the exception of Spurs away, a lot of the matches are games, or all of the matches are games you would expect City to win and possibly win comfortably. Brighton next week is a potential banana skin, but Brighton haven't been very good for a little while now. So, yeah, this really does feel like a big turning point in the season. In terms of the match itself between Arsenal and Villa, I found it really interesting to watch because it was a bit of a slow burn. So Arsenal looked strong in the first half. They were moving the ball quickly. They were getting Martin Odegaard on the ball a lot, which I always think is an indicator of how Arsenal are playing and whether they're going to create chances. And in that first period, they did create chances. They had 14 shots, 1.23 XG. But even in that first half, there was a sign of what would ultimately unfold. When Arsenal made a mistake, they gave up the ball easily, and Ollie Watkins somehow hit the inside of the far post. And then the ball kind of spun back across the line and then out for a goal kick on the other side. Kind of unusual. We saw more of that sort of thing in the second half, although it was more sustained from Villa. They started so much more proactively at the start of the second half. They took the game to Arsenal and were really impressive. Keep in mind, this was the second time that Villa have beaten Arsenal this season. And sorry, Arsenal fans, the narrative of Unai Emery being the one to derail their title challenge is just it's just irresistible, isn't it? It's narrative overload that he might be the one that ends up costing them.
Yeah, there are some good stats out there about Emery's success rate at the Emirates, which regardless of the team he has been coaching there. Thanks for the six was trending on Twitter as well after that. Thanks for the 6 points Emery has taken from his former side this season. Taylor, what do we make of this one? Are we still keeping Arsenal in the hunt?
I mean, yes, but no. I think this is the weekend that Man City probably go ahead and stayed ahead. We should never write anybody off. We should never say it's done, but it does feel like it is. I went back and looked, while I was continuing the trend of going back and looking at notes I had made, I went back and looked at the big thing we did about the case for each team that's still in the title race. Here were some of our concerns about Arsenal. That they were relying on set-piece goals, and not even penalty goals, but just set-piece goals that were 30% of their goals at the time. Could they keep that going? I think they have not. We had some concerns about can Gabriel Jesus actually stay fit for a whole season? That has not been the case. And we had concerns about the goalkeeping situation, and would it be stable? And it has not been stable. So I think some of the concerns there have, if not come home to roost, then at least loomed a little bit larger than they were at the time we recorded that one. And I think for Arsenal, it was just a game in which, to Unai Emery's credit, I think it was close to a tactical masterclass, if not one outright. I thought he got his tactics perfect. I think he knew exactly what Arsenal wanted to do. I think he backed his team to ride some of the early threats and then end up getting the result that they needed and getting the goals that they needed. So I think a ton of credit to Villa. But for Arsenal, I think it has to just be another case of what could have been. And if they took some chances cleanly, if you don't have the Emi Martinez double save in the first couple minutes or in the opening stages of this game, just how different it might have been. And so I think It's a season in which Arsenal have made massive progress. We've talked about it many, many times. I think they will continue to make massive progress. But maybe this is the first season, and the next season is when they actually end up putting it all together. That's not a thing that Arsenal supporters will want to hear, because I feel like that's a thing that they are used to hearing.
Wasn't that last season?
Yeah, I was going to say last season to this season.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, to hop in on that, Taylor, it is an incredibly frustrating result for Arsenal. And I guess in some ways I'm both surprised and unsurprised by the way this game went down. So Michael Cox had a good piece for The Athletic that kind of broke down some of the individual moments, lots of screen grabs in it, where Arsenal found themselves in good positions in the attacking third and just either mistimed the last action or missed the obvious pass or the obvious off-ball run. He wasn't the biggest person at fault in this game, but maybe my favorite example was a Bukayo Saka example in the first half. It's a lovely Martin Odegaard through ball in the 20th minute to Saka streaking in behind the back line. Maybe you all are remembering this pass because it's very, very good. And the ball is so good, it puts Saka in a good spot. But Saka's first touch just takes him ever so slightly too far wide towards the right. And that lets Aston Villa center back Pau Torres come in and close the angle and really limits what Saka could do on the ball. Obviously, Arsenal don't get on the score sheet in this game. Saka doesn't score in that moment. There were so many of those moments, whether it was Gabriel Jesus or Kai Havertz in the final third. They were finding their players in the first half, streaking in behind. Zinchenko starting at left back in this game. He had some good bits of distribution, which is what we would expect. But none of those things really came off. And Taylor, you talked about some of the attacking struggles that Arsenal have had this year. Obviously, they're still a very good attacking team, but the question has always been, are they good enough in open play to get some of these key results? And the answer was probably no. But their saving grace all season long has been set pieces, which were not a huge factor in this game, but also how strong their defense has been. I've talked about this, Graham. You spent a lot of time talking about this recently as the thing that differentiates Arsenal. And that's why, and this is where the surprising bit comes in, the first goal that Aston Villa score, the ball trickles all the way across. There's several Arsenal defenders that can't get it clear, and it's Declan Rice kind of hanging out towards the weak side, and he is not really fully engaged, and I don't think he's ever imagining that ball's making it to him in the first place. And bing, bang, boom, Leon Bailey's at the back post and scoring in the 84th minute, and at this point, Arsenal are in very, very deep trouble. So that was a surprising bit for me, that when Arsenal have stuttered in the attack this year, they have more than made up for it in other phases of play, and that just didn't really happen in this game. The last thing for me on the title race and in general, my thoughts on this game, I looked up the betting odds and sort of the implied percentages on the couple of odds makers that I found. Man City sitting at about 70% to win the Premier League title. Arsenal are sitting at about 20% to win the Premier League title, and Liverpool are sitting at about 10%. Like, things skewed dramatically towards Man City with these three results.
Wow. What a difference a week can make, Joe. Thank you for that insight there. Yeah, it's in Man City's hands now, of course. Six games to go. They've got the penultimate game is a trip to Tottenham. I'm identifying that potentially as a potential slip. We shall see there.
You saw Tottenham this weekend, right?
Yeah, but, you know, they're a roller coaster. You never
also
know.
Also, are Arsenal relying on Tottenham pulling out a result for them to win the Premier League title?
Yeah. Lasagna makers beware in the North London area on that game, was all I will say. FA Cup semi-final coming up next weekend for City as well, and they've got Champions League obligations. So you never know. 2 points separating the top three sides. Stranger things have happened. We shall see how this one turns out. A couple other games to mention from the Premier League this weekend real quick. You mentioned them just a second ago. Spurs with a 4-0 loss at Newcastle. Alexander Isak with a brace in this one. That one put Newcastle into sixth place. Big Ange Graham said this was a self-inflicted defeat, his heaviest defeat since taking charge of Tottenham. Yikes.
Yeah, every so often this season there has been a performance like this from Spurs. This was maybe the most extreme example of that, but we had one a few weeks ago where they lost 3-0 to Fulham. But even that game, I'm not sure Spurs were as bad as they were in this one. They just didn't deal well with the Newcastle setup, which saw them go man for man out of possession. The space between the midfield and defence was too big, and that gave Newcastle's runners just so much room to exploit. And Postecoglou highlighted a lack of tempo and intensity afterwards, so that was a factor too. It was disjointed. It didn't feel like Tottenham had a lot of ideas on how to break down Newcastle. I think Newcastle had, I have the number here, 27% possession in this game. But when they did have the ball, they were quick, they were sharp, they were incisive. It helped that Mickey van de Ven halfway through the match decided he was just going to break dance. That did help.
The memes, yeah. Incredible work, everybody online. Just a great weekend for the internet.
Indeed. But Alexander Isak was the beneficiary of Van de Ven's performance. He was very, very, very good. Horrendous matchup for Van de Ven, because the way Spurs play under Postecoglou, their defensive line is high up and they kind of rely on Van de Ven's physical attributes. How many times have we seen, talking about stuff on the internet, how many times have we seen a video of him doing like 100 metres in about 10 seconds to recover a situation and win the ball back? That's gone viral a few times this season. He does it all the time. But against Alexander Isak, Van de Ven is up against someone who could match him for that pace and get him behind, and the pressure from the Spurs midfield on Gordon and Harvey Barnes or whoever was playing against the ball, it just wasn't enough. So frequently it felt like Newcastle were always one pass from getting in behind, and Alexander Isak made the most of that.
Yeah,
I hear what you say, Graham, about them not closing down fast enough, and I think that is definitely true. I think also part of that is where Spurs kept losing the ball, which it felt like Newcastle's plan of sort of funneling them towards the middle, then winning, and then Bruno Guimarães going long regularly, and two goals come straight from him winning the ball and then just hoofing it long. And hoofing it long sounds like he's just clearing it and it's hopeful. It's definitely targeted. It feels like there was an awareness that with the way Spurs were going to attack, the shape they're going to take, where people are going to be, there is a vulnerability to those direct balls. It's not something I necessarily think of as being a characteristic or a consistent opportunity when you're playing against Spurs, but clearly Newcastle did, because it's a thing that they targeted early and often, and it worked multiple times. So much so that it had me realizing, maybe this is a thing that happens all the time, but it happened three times this weekend, and I think it's because the first one I saw was Duncan Maguire for Orlando, with people being like, how was he onside? Because he gets a ball, he seems to be 30 yards off, he scores, and then they go back and the replay shows that he started his run in his own half. That happened for an Isak goal in this one, that happened for the Ollie Watkins goal for Villa. Is that an outlier? Does that happen all the time? Or am I right in saying that it's weird that that happened three times in one weekend?
No, that is a bit weird. We've also had there was a Leandro Trossard one a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if he starts in his own half. It might have been against Brighton, actually, last week, where he's very deep and has like the whole half to run into. Ryan Gold scored one for Vancouver, I think, like a couple of weeks ago. So there has been a little flurry of those kind of attacks.
And for Mickey Van de Ven, Graham and Joe already made stellar points and mocked him. I will just say I felt so bad that at 3-0, he does finally make one of those heroic blocks Graham is talking about. He gets across, he gets a block in. It felt like it was going to be another goal for, I believe, Anthony Gordon. No big deal. He's finally done it. Concedes a corner, and then they scored from the corner. So even there, it feels like he maybe was doing some thankless work in this game.
Yeah. Mickey, not so fine. Mickey, not blow my mind, Taylor, in this instance. Great moment from this game.
Hey,
Newcastle.
Mickey. Hey, Mickey. Yeah, you have to say it's sad instead of happy and chipper with clapping.
Very nice. Very solemn. I like that. Newcastle had a lovely moment in the stands. They had some deaf fans wearing jerseys with haptic feedback in them to vibrate when action took place on the field to help them feel the atmosphere of the stadium. And a moment where Dan Byrne did some British Sign Language as a celebration to the deaf fans in attendance at St James's Park. He was signing for the fans and not Tottenham are terrible today, I am told. very good. Taylor, one other game in the Premier League. No. Bournemouth with a 2-2 draw against Manchester United. A late penalty was denied for Bournemouth after a lengthy VAR review in this one. Man United have won just one of their last seven games in the Premier League. Taylor,
what?
As a child of the 90s, it still amazes me week in, week out that Man United have become this, frankly.
Yes, I love it. It's so fun. It makes me so happy.
I mean,
it's really one of my favorite things. It's what makes it really hard for me, a person who wanted Erik ten Hag to be a solution for a good long while, to see him as the solution when they continue to be erratic. Graham will attest, I texted him after that Liverpool, or after the Chelsea loss, excuse me. It was just like, I don't see how he keeps the job. Even if he is not the problem, it is still a sign that he is not developing players into being somewhat better than they've been. Joe is texting, get better players in the chat. Joe is not wrong to argue that. I would say that they have gotten several better players under Erik ten Hag, and I don't think that they have made that team overall better or more consistently better in this game. Diogo Dalot especially is just all over the place. Sometimes he's a right back, sometimes he's a right winger, sometimes he's a center back, sometimes he's a central midfielder. Never really with a plan, never really knowing himself where he needed to be. They were on their like ninth choice center back pairing, I believe. So maybe they should get some more center backs in there too. Joe wants more players in the chat. But it just felt to me like another game in which I'm not saying that Bournemouth played a bad game. I think Bournemouth should have gotten that penalty. I understand why it wasn't. It's a spirit of the game thing for me. That definitely should have been a penalty in my mind. It just is more erratic performances.
What, the one at the end?
Yeah.
That's outside the box, though.
I would say contact is just barely outside of the box. And to me, Kambwala, his heel is inside the box when that contact occurs. And to me, he is stopping a runner from getting into the box to get a shooting opportunity. I mean, yes, the contact initially occurs just outside the box, but very much continues in my opinion. I understand the rules. I understand why it wasn't given as one. Still think it should have been.
Every bit of me wants to argue it was a penalty because it's Ryan Christie. But yeah, that's if there's a dubious penalty in this game, for me, it's the Manchester United one that when it hits the...
You mean the deliberate handball that totally was intentional?
If that's how you see it, then sure.
I mean, but Graham, do you disagree with my overall sentiment that, like, he doesn't seem to be getting the buy-in, making this team better? Now, maybe that means there needs to be a squad clear-out and even more people need to go, but I just don't see Erik ten Hag making them better from week to week.
I think whether he should be or not, he's done, he'll be gone this summer. I think Manchester United, had they lost this game, this would be the most defeats in a single Premier League season ever. Which is quite a thought to when you think about the terrible seasons they've had in the post-Ferguson era, that this might be the worst of them all, at least by that metric. I look at some of the... There's just weird things going on in this Manchester United team. Like, I don't know if you caught this, Taylor. Before the first Bournemouth goal, so it looks like... It might actually be the second one. What's the one where Kwambala gets kind of tied in knots and he falls over and
that's the first
score.
One. Yeah.
The first goal, right, it is the first goal. Dalot plays a really big role in him and Kwambala being exposed because there's like some really bewildering movement for the Inanna kick out where he's like running in circles in the middle of the pitch, then goes out to the right side. Inanna's looking at him like, what are you doing?
Yep.
Like nobody is moving around him, and then just kicks it straight to a Bournemouth player and they score. Like there's just weird moments like that. Now I don't know how much of that is on Erik ten Hag or whether that is just stupidity from players, but it's a weird team to work out. And you look at players like Casemiro, he is gassed. Like I thought he was 34, 35. He's 32 years old. He's my age. Why is he struggling to play Premier League matches? It's bewildering. And I do.
Would you struggle, Graham?
I would struggle, but that's not the point. I'm not an elite athlete.
Graham might struggle. We all might struggle. I will say this: if I brought a ball down with very little pressure, took a heavy touch, lost possession, and then realized, oh, I've lost possession within 30 yards of my own goal, I would probably sprint back and try to win that ball back out of sheer embarrassment. And there is a moment when Casemiro does exactly that and then almost shrugs and sort of jogs back as Bournemouth develop an attack and I think end up getting a corner out of it. Yeah, the lack of intensity there is pretty consistent. And then there's the Dalot one for the first goal. There's the one where he's way too wide and they're just able to pass right through them for the second. Not a lot of consistency, not a lot of coherency to this Man United team. Credit to Bournemouth, because I think they could have won. And there is also the Andre Onana point-blank save or double save off of Justin Kluivert that could have made it 3-2 as well.
I really make this point with a team because I think often it's quite a lazy sort of tabloidy thing. I kind of wonder if Ten Hag doesn't have the buy-in of that dressing room
There's
anymore.
No way he does.
You look at Alejandro Garnacho, who's hooked at half-time, and then after the game, likes a bunch of tweets saying Ten Hag threw him under the bus and the decision to take him off was a joke. I've seen this movie play out before and it ends with a loan to Borussia Dortmund. Like, this has happened to Manchester United players this season. There's been stuff with Rashford as well. It just doesn't seem like a happy camp. And Ten Hag probably isn't to blame for that. This is a chaotic club, but we all know the easiest and often cheapest decision a club can make is to get rid of the manager. So I'll be very surprised if he's in charge for the start next season.
I don't want to keep going on Man United because I know they are a boring topic unless you like Manchester United, which I do. But I will say, I think if he goes, I don't think it's fair necessarily. I also don't think it's unfair. I think there are problem players who leak stuff to the media and have a lot of sway in that locker room and a lot of sway in that club. And I think if you are Ineos and you are truly going to make changes, I think their hand is forced a little bit, and I think they can sell some of those players and reestablish the identity that no one is bigger than that club. But I also don't think that you can then sell those players and be like, Erik ten Hag is the guy. You all loved him. We got these problem players out. Now it's all going to work swimmingly. I think it's probably a summer of both. I think it's a new manager, and I think there is somewhat of a clear out there as well, because I don't think either one is working particularly well. So it feels weird because I still like Erik ten Hag. I think he'll be a good manager wherever he ends up next, but it does not feel like it's the right situation for him at Manchester United at present.
All right, we need to take a break. When we come back, a quick look around the rest of Europe. Look at MLS. Back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs, who would like to remind you when you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. You don't want to end up with Ryan, Graham, and Joe. Just kidding. Just kidding. Very much just kidding. Because I was very fortunate to have the three of them all join the show. And I had existing relationships with all three of them that allowed me to know that they could handle the amount of work that would be required, that they could be diligent in their tasks and be very effective on mic. And all three of them are. But again, that's because you have the existing relationship. If you don't feel like you have that with potential hires, then LinkedIn is going to make it very, very easy, and they're going to make it feel like you are connected to that person. They have a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire because it gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. But when you are setting the requirements and making it very specific as to what you're looking for, you can very quickly narrow it down to find the right candidate for that position. Hiring is easy when you have that many candidates, so easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. And LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring, and you can too. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions do apply. Thank you very much to LinkedIn for sponsoring today's episode. Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our weekend review. Just a quick jump back, Joe, to the Premier League for us with a 2-2 draw against Wolves. Gio, playing some soccer.
Got his first start for Nottingham Forest in the Premier League. A good moment for him. Nice assist off of a set piece. He was sharp in this game. I think shows very clearly that he is comfortable at this kind of level. That's no real surprise for anybody who's watched him with the U.S. men's national team or even watched him with Dortmund. He is very, very good. Whether he will parlay this impactful performance into more starts, I don't know, because Nottingham Forest are in some trouble. But Gio Reyna, very, very good. Good to see him start.
Was that twobble?
You just a little twobble, a little Looney Tunes action on a Monday morning.
Excellent. Love it. Love it. Let's take a trip to Spain, Graham. Cadiz with a 1-0 home defeat at the hands of Barcelona. Joao Felix with a nice overhead kick in this one.
Very nice. It was. It was tremendous, actually. An overhead scissor kick inside the six-yard box with players all around him. Not sure what happens to him next season, by the way, because he is, at this point, a second-string player for Barcelona, and he sort of burned his bridges emphatically with Atletico Madrid. He's, of course, still on loan there. So not entirely sure how this that one pans out for him individually.
individually, a huge amount of rotation for Barcelona for this match with the PSG second leg just around the corner. No Lewandowski, no Rafinha, no De Jong, no Pedri, no Lamine Yamal, no Koundé, no Gundogan, no Cancelo. It was basically an entirely different team. In the end, no problem for Barcelona. I think that level of rotation came across in the standard of performance, which was a bit disjointed and uneven, but it was still good enough from Barcelona against a relegation-threatened team that did cause some problems, particularly in the opening 20 minutes, and then there was a period in the second half as well where Cadiz did have some shots. But it's all about that PSG second leg for Barcelona. It feels like a season-defining game for them.
Indeed, yeah. Big week coming up for Barcelona. Clásico next weekend as well, lest we forget. Mallorca had a 1-0 defeat at the hands of Real Madrid. Too many with a lovely long ranger in a hard-fought win for Real.
Indeed, a bit of rotation from Ancelotti in this match as well, although maybe not to the same extent of Barcelona's, but still no Vinicius, at least in the first half. He comes off the bench in the second half. No Camavinga, no Carvajal, Rodrigo and Toni Kroos also on the bench, but it was a fairly measured performance from Real Madrid for the most part, where they were able to keep Mallorca and Marici, who's had an excellent season, he's their main danger man, at arm's length. The winner from Tchouaméni is deflected, but you're right, Ryan, it's still from miles out and is an incredible strike. And it wasn't really until Vinicius came off the bench in the second half that the game opened up a little bit. It was a little bit dull up until that point, but a 1-0 win for Real Madrid edges them closer to the finish line in La Liga, and as you say, the Clásico next week could push them even further ahead of Barcelona at the top of the table.
Yes, indeed. The finish line a little way in the distance for Girona. We thought it might be a bit closer earlier in the season. They had a 3-1 defeat at Atleti.
Yeah, remember those heady days when we spoke about Girona as potential title
that
challengers?
That genuinely feels like 3 years ago.
Yeah, wow, I was going to say, somehow it feels like yesterday and also like 100 years ago at the same time. Girona are probably still going to finish in the top four, although results like this won't help them. Athletic Club drew at home to Villarreal on Sunday. Had they won that game, then a little bit more pressure on Girona. It was an incredible start by Girona, who were ahead after 4 minutes. It was a really nice goal that included Savinho and Jan Couto on the overlap, and then it's Jovic finishing at the back post. To be honest, Girona were comfortable for a lot of this match against Atleti, and the home fans were starting to get a little bit antsy. They had control of the midfield. Atleti weren't getting in behind. The breaks, however, went Atleti's way. They got a penalty kick for a handball to equalise. It's a lapse of concentration that allows Morata to cross for Correa to put them 2-1 up at half-time, which really did feel like an injustice given how sleepy Atleti were and how well Girona had played. And then it's a defensive ricochet that leads to Griezmann making it 3-1. So the break certainly didn't go Girona's way. A scoreline that maybe doesn't fully reflect how comfortable Girona were for large periods. They might not be getting the results that they had in the first half of the season, but they are still a very impressive team.
Over to Italy, where the headline came in Udine. Udinese's draw with Roma was suspended, in fact, after Roma defender Evan Indica collapsed off the ball in the 72nd minute. He was conscious but clearly in pain, rubbing his chest as the medical team came towards him. He was carried off, but giving a kind of thumbs up gesture as he went off. There was a lengthy delay. The game was then suspended. Thankfully, reports from Sunday night suggesting he was safe and out of danger in hospital after checks, and seems, Graham, to be doing well now, thankfully.
Yeah, this match was abandoned midway through the second half, and I think the reporting I've seen is that the Udinese and Roma players were given the option to play the rest of the game, and they didn't feel like continuing, which is completely understandable, so it was abandoned. But yeah, this was just a reminder of what really matters, and hopefully Evan Indica is going to make a full recovery and find out what happened so measures can be taken so it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Elsewhere in Italy, quite a few ties happening in the league, which feels very Italian. Inter with a 2-2 draw with Cagliari, giving up the lead twice in that one. 14 points ahead with 6 games to go. Up next for them, Milan derby in the league. Very nice next weekend.
And I think they can clinch the Scudetto if they beat AC Milan in that derby. I think that was one of the consequences of this result. I think a draw previously would have been enough had they won this one, but a draw against Cagliari means that they need to beat AC Milan, so that could be quite something, and certainly something that motivates them next week, because Inter are in this weird moment where they're kind of just waiting for the end of the season to be crowned champions. There's not a whole lot else going on in terms of this game, and Inzaghi was unhappy with how Inter allowed Cagliari back into the match twice, and it's a little bit lethargic. But yeah, all eyes on the Derby della Madonnina next week. I love that name.
One of the best names of the derbies. Graham. And Milan with a 3-3 draw with Sassuolo. Also, the Turin derby this previous weekend ending 0-0 between Torino and Juventus. Last but absolutely not least, on the weekend review, we go to Joe Lowry's MLS Corner. Joe, the game that caught my eye happening at Arrowhead Taylor Swift's home stadium, into Miami with a 3-2 win over Sporting KC in that one. 72,000 something people in there. The largest soccer crowd in Missouri history, they were calling it. Do you think they were hoping for in MLS history when they were trying to fill that thing up, maybe?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't think so, because I'm pretty sure the Rose Bowl is bigger and the Galaxy and LAFC did that last year. So I don't think that was ever on the table. But I must admit, I'm not an Arrowhead Stadium seating capacity expert. This game, though, was very, very fun for folks that turned up to see Messi and to see Inter Miami. A bit of a revenge game for Leo Messi after just complete utter failure for Inter Miami against Monterrey in the Champions Cup last week. They were pretty darn sharp in this match. I continue to think they probably look a bit better in this back four than they have in a back three this year. Either way, Messi, very, very impactful, has the assist for Diego Gomez's goal that makes it 1-1 after a mistake from Chelo on the first goal for SKC. Then Messi scores a banger in the second half, and Luis Suarez finishes things off in the 71st minute. That goal from Suarez comes off of a Diego Gomez assist. I thought this was one of his better games in Inter Miami shirt. I know there are a lot of folks around the game, not just in the United States, that are very high on Diego Gomez. I still just don't see it a whole lot for him. He's so raw on the ball. But in this game, he did show a bit of poise. He did show a bit of control. And also, he's so dynamic. And this is what people like about him. He's so dynamic off the ball, providing that vertical threat. He was sharp in this game. SKC had it. They were sort of on the brink. I don't think they necessarily had a bad game, although I'm not sold on their defense whatsoever. We saw the 4-2-3-1 from Peter Vermes with Alan Pulido and Willy Agata on the field together. And we saw Graham's favorite, Johnny Russell, come off the bench. He's getting back to full fitness. I think for SKC, this is just a case of coming up against the GOAT at a time when the GOAT is very angry, because he and his team kind of flopped a few days earlier. That is Inter Miami's win over Sporting Kansas City. Another game that caught my eye, CF Montreal take down FC Cincinnati, who are not playing like a team that won the Supporter Shield last year. They've been struggling in recent weeks. CF Montreal, their first home game of the season after six straight on the road because of weather and other, you know, home stadium challenges being up in the north. And they put in a really sharp performance against Cincinnati, controlling the ball. They created the better chances. They go up into halftime, up 1-0. Like, they were legitimately fun and good, and they look like they might be a fun and good team, which is incredibly impressive. A lot of respect for what this organization is doing specifically. I know I'm often hesitant to give managers credit. Laurent Courtois, we had a clear example of what this Montreal team was last year. And a huge part of why it's so difficult to judge managers is that it all feels so murky. Well, they didn't make a ton of impactful changes over the offseason. They do go out and get Laurent Courtois as their new coach, and they have at least a very clear way of playing. I think this team still has a fairly low ceiling, but man, they're playing actual fun and good soccer. I'll take us to one more game before we move on, and we'll obviously have more MLS chat on the show tomorrow. Portland Timbers 2, LAFC 2, just a fun game between two teams trying to find themselves in the Western Conference. The Timbers scored like two identical goals with the same weird outswinging ball from, like, it's not quite the half space, it's more just the middle of the field. Evander plays a lovely, lovely ball into Felipe Mora, who maybe gets a shin guard on it, maybe not. It's really, really hard to tell. They gave the goal to Mora. It's a great bit of distribution from Evander, and then Evander gets on the end of a very similar piece of distribution from Juan Mosquera right back for the Portland Timbers. LAFC, poor defending and stretches in this game. They're still dynamic going the other way in transition. Issues for both of these teams, but man, I've been critical of Evander, and I want to give him credit where it's due. He was very, very good in this game and has looked better now that Jonathan Rodriguez is in the lineup as well.
Wonderful stuff, Joe. As Joe mentioned, more MLS and American Soccer Chat coming on the feed on Tuesday's show. But for now, we're going to park the Weekend Review. Weekend Review Extra coming on patreon.com/Total Soccer Show with a bit more discussion on Wrexham, on a few more of the title battles from around the globe. But for now, Taylor Rockwell, thank you very much for your participation in this here endeavour.
Thank you, my friend.
Graham Ruffin, pleasure as always.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
Joe Lowry, thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Listener, thank you the most is for joining us. We'll be back on the feed very shortly, but for now, bye!